Welcome to the Satellite Evolution Global Podcast Series, where we explore all things satellite. In this episode, we will take a deep dive into the economics of satellite and space. So, over to you, Crispin and Chad.
Well, greetings to all of our listeners, and welcome to the Universe of Bright Minds, our new podcast series. I'm your host, Crispin Littlehales, and today we're going to be hearing from Chad Anderson, the founder and managing partner of Space Capital, which is widely recognized as one of the top venture capital firms focusing on the satellite and space industry. Chad is not just a seasoned investor. He is also an author of The Space Economy, which I read, a very readable, very insightful book that explains just why our industry presents such an enormous business opportunity. So without further ado, welcome, Chad, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Crispin. Good to be here, and I appreciate the kind intro.
Yeah, absolutely. So listen, we've got a lot of ground to cover, but before we delve in, I'm interested in your origin story, and I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how and why you founded Space Capital.
Yeah, sure. So we've been doing this for a while. I am finance and economics undergrad and an MBA, so business guy. I have been an entrepreneur a couple of times in the past. And was managing a large real estate portfolio with JPMorgan Chase through the Great Recession. And I came out the other end of that with a nice cushy corner office, but I was a little too early in my career to sort of ride off into the sunset. So I went to business school to sort of change tacks. And that was 2012. I was there studying, really focusing on nascent markets and how they develop. There's a really great professor there that teaches at Stanford and Oxford that talks about nascent markets, right? It's happened many times throughout history. There's high barriers to entry that keep new entrants out. The incumbents get fat and happy until something structural changes. The barriers to entry go away, and in comes this wave of entrepreneurship, innovation, and private capital. That was 2012 that I was studying that, and that was the year that SpaceX launched the space station and delivered cargo to NASA, to the space station for NASA for the first time. They just come online and launched their first customer a few years prior. So I was actually just recognizing that, that this was a nascent market in development. The SpaceX was removing the barriers to entry, and kind of read the tea leaves and knew that there was an opportunity that all these new entrepreneurs, these new entrants, were going to need capital. And so I decided to set up a fund to focus on these entrepreneurs. And I was a little too early to the game. Again, SpaceX was just coming online, so there weren't a lot of deals or investor interest at that time. So stayed in the UK, helped them set up an innovation center to grow the space sector in the country. There, I did that during the day. And then on the US hours during the evening, I was building the foundations of this fund. And then 2015, moved to New York to do this full time. There's finally enough going on to try my hand at that. We invested in our first company, Planet Labs, in 2015. And yeah, I knew if I wanted to do this for real, I had learned a lot about the technology over the last few years, but I'm a business guy. So I knew if I wanted to do this for real, I needed to get a technical co-founder. So I made a short list of folks. At the very top of that list was Tom Ingersoll. He's a very accomplished space entrepreneur, sold a venture-backed space company in 2009, a higher profile one in 2015 when he sold Skybox Imaging to Google for $500 million. Hmm. And so, yeah, so we teamed up and we're now on, our, third fund. And, you know, we've been paddling out, and we've caught a really massive wave. So there's a lot going on right now and now we get to ride it.
Well, that's so exciting. And, how fortunate of you. And your timing of doing all of this, just as Elon Musk and SpaceX are starting what is like such a massive disruption in this industry. And so it's the ripples keep on rippling out. I know that you recently released your 2024 Q4 Space IQ report, which I know you do every quarter, and they're excellent. I love reading them. Could you give our listeners a sense of what some of the key findings were?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so this is based on data that I've been aggregating since 2012. This is actually part of when I back in 2012 when I was thinking about, is there an opportunity here? This is the data that I collected to help, convince myself that there was something going on, that there was a seismic shift happening, that it wasn't just SpaceX, that there was more going on. And so this is a massive database that we've been collecting for over 10 years, and we now make it publicly available. In our report, our Space Investment Quarterly, and also on our website, there's a Space IQ page that you can visit where the data is interactive, and so you can play around with it and slice and dice it in a bunch of different ways. But the data is one thing, but what we really do every quarter is to dive into that data and try to interpret it and help determine what that data is telling us, right? So, this was probably one of the biggest takeaways is that 2024 on the whole is up 30% year over year. So the capital markets have been really tight after the run up and the zero interest rate period through 2021. Capital was very cheap. There was a lot of money sloshing around. Things got tight over the last, 2 and a half years. 2022 and 2023 were a really difficult fundraising environment for founders. It seems like that has turned around a bit in 2024. So 2023 might have been the bottom. We're up 30% year over year. Investment in space infrastructure, launch vehicles, satellites in orbit, some emerging industries. We've seen healthy investment continued in those areas, a lot of which is due to the fact that space technologies are essential for our economic growth and national security. Governments are continuing to make large contracts available for folks. We have hundreds of billions of dollars of infrastructure in orbit that needs to be upgraded and replaced. So there's a lot of opportunity there for folks. But probably the biggest driver here is the applications of space data. So this is the software applications that are built, solutions, market solutions for end customers in various different industries are leveraging data that's coming off of satellites in orbit. The applications layer was hit the hardest over the last, 2 years in this market correction. That's come back in a big way, up 200 plus percent in 2024 versus the year before. So this is really important because, space infrastructure is really exciting. It's also very important. I mean, you can't run software if there's no hardware to run it on. So the hardware is important, but it's also how you're using that infrastructure. The market demand for what you're building is also very important. So the fact that we've got more demand, and a bounce back on the application layer is really important indicator, I think.
So I'm going to delve into applications for just a second here. That means things like GPS or IoT. Is that what we're talking? Weather data, maybe data for military use? Is that kind of what we're talking about here?
Well, so this framework that we've come up with in we produce a lot of research. We do a lot of research and we publish a lot of that publicly. And sort of our seminal thesis paper, the GPS Playbook, looks at GPS as the most successful space technology in existence. Like, how did it go from being a niche government capability that was really off limits to anyone else by design? How did it go from being that to being ubiquitous in our everyday lives and generating trillions of dollars in economic value and some of the largest venture returns that the world's ever seen? Well, satellites, right, for example, in the 70s, built by Lockheed for the government, Trimble comes along in the early 80s, builds a commercial GPS receiver that allows regular folks to access this really valuable positioning data from orbit and timing data, which allows for applications to then be built on top of this data. So basically, the tech communities in Silicon Valley and other places could then buy a commercial GPS receiver from Trimble and others, and develop really valuable applications for end users based on this data from orbit. It abstracted away the complexity of orbital mechanics and satellites in orbit and how they work. Like you just had to know, you just had to buy this receiver, and you could and build software applications, which gave rise to Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, Grubhub, Tinder, you name it. All of the apps that we know and love that drive our Google Maps, that drive the world today, these applications are where a lot of the value accrues. So that's, looking at it from a GPS perspective. The same thing is happening in geospatial intelligence. We have all these Earth observation images, or sorry, satellites, providing all of this data from orbit. And now, through new tooling like SkyWatch, a company in our portfolio, they've aggregated all that data, structured it, made it really easily accessible through an API. So again, just like Trimble did with GPS, we're now abstracting away the complexity of accessing this really valuable Earth observation data from orbit. We're now seeing applications being built on top of that in some of the largest multi-trillion dollar industries here on Earth: construction, real estate, mining, maritime, shipping, logistics, agriculture, insurance, you name it. So applications, that's what we mean, is the software applications that are leveraging this data and actually building the software applications that end users, consumers, enterprises, governments actually use to access the data from orbit.
So where does AI fit into all of this?
Well, so we see that play to show up most prominently in the application layer. Geospatial intelligence is one of the biggest areas of application. So while AI is transforming capabilities across the space economy, I think it shows up most prominently in geospatial intelligence. So again, we've got all these, SpaceX removes the barriers to entry, makes space accessible and affordable. We see all these new satellites being launched, starting with Skybox Imaging, Planet Labs, others that are launching all kinds of new sensors, cameras and optical sensors, but also radar and hyperspectral and a whole diff, a whole array of satellite sensors. We have this unprecedented amount of data from orbit that is really impossible for humans. There's so much data that it's impossible for humans to comb through it all, to process it, to annotate it, and try to derive useful insights from, unless you run it through an AI system. So this is another one of these sort of secular tailwinds that's providing, that's an accelerant to what's all this growth that we're seeing in the space economy, is that AI is coming online, useful. AI is coming online at exactly, the time in which we have all this data and that we're bringing it all down to the ground and distributing it out to folks. And now we have tools that are allowing us to make use of this data, drive useful insights from it. And, we've invested pretty heavily over the last few years into companies that are doing this.
So I can certainly understand with software and AI that there's a bit more of a quick turnaround than there is in other areas of the space industry, which can be so like the infrastructure or launch or even the building of of satellites themselves. It's so cost intensive, and still we've got some long timelines. Look at New Glenn, for example, but I take it that your company and other venture capitalists and investors are investing beyond just these layers of software. And I'm kind of curious how what's the money making strategy behind this? What's the exit strategy for VCs, especially with these longer timelines, more cost intensive projects?
Yeah, so I think when most people think about space, they think about the Apollo moon landings and the International Space Station and sort of these grand human achievements, these big government programs. But they don't think about the entrepreneurs that are transforming nearly every major industry here on Earth. But that is the opportunity that we're focused on at Space Capital. We have put forward these frameworks for thinking about the opportunity in the space economy. And we use the term space economy because it's much greater than just an industry. It is a collection of many industries. You've got launch as an industry, you've got satellites as an industry, and you've got some emerging industries, which are lunar markets, manufacturing in orbit, commercial space stations, these types of new markets. And so Gideon, if you want to understand the opportunity in the space economy, it is massive. It's not a niche capability. These are the technologies that power the world's largest industries today. The modern global economy runs on GPS. So, segmenting the market, looking segmenting the market by industry and looking at launch. Launch is very different than satellites. Satellites is very different than lunar markets, right? But then also leveraging these frameworks that we have come up with and put forward in our research, like the using infrastructure distribution applications. This allows you to understand the breadth of the opportunity, which is massive, and it also helps you to, helps us to develop a very diversified portfolio of companies. So, for example, we're investing in, we understand the technology very well. We're category experts. We've been doing this a long time. We understand the technology and the markets and where things are going, right? So we're investing in some infrastructure companies on the satellite infrastructure side. So on the Earth observation satellites that are going up, we've invested in quite a few companies there. We've invested in the distribution layer. So we've invested in a company called SkyWatch that is, like I mentioned, aggregating data from all the different data providers, structuring it, and making it really easily accessible through an API. We've also invested in applications companies that are tapping into that API and developing applications for parametric insurance in construction, project management, mining, real estate, and a bunch of other areas. By understanding the end market, like the market demand on the application side, that will allow you to then understand what questions the market's asking, what information is in demand, and what infrastructure is missing in order to be able to answer those questions. So then you can, have a very informed opinion on what infrastructure needs to be built. Not this, hey, we can build a really cool satellite, let's build it and then see if anyone will buy it. You can actually build and invest in infrastructure knowing that there is already market demand for it. And so this is a really, it's a very powerful flywheel that we have spinning at high speed right now that's enabling us to invest across the different technology layers and build a very interesting and diversified portfolio. I think when we got started in 2012, there wasn't anyone else who was thinking about setting up a venture capital fund focused on space. And in fact, quite a few interesting looks when people heard what we were doing, right? Well, today it's a very different story, right? Especially through 2021, VC firms focused on space have been popping up left and right. I think what many of them get wrong is that they come in and they're easily attracted to the shiny object, right? They look at the smoke and fire, they see launch, and they invest in that. That's incredibly difficult, technically and from a business perspective. So they're putting together a portfolio of launch and emerging industries, which are very risky, very new, really government-led. So if you come in and, if you're just looking at this from an investment perspective, focusing on the space infrastructure, you're gonna have a really difficult portfolio. You're gonna be letting other folks come in and invest in the applications that are extracting a lot of the value.
Right.
It's this diversified approach that allows us to build what I think is a very interesting portfolio focused on the opportunity set.
I wish I had $1 million. I'd give it to you right away. But instead, we're going to take a very short break and we're going to be back soon So, all you listeners, stay tuned.
Satellite Evolution Global Podcast Series is sponsored by Proactive International PR, one of the leading global technology and marketing agencies that delivers integrated communications campaigns.
Hey, we're back with Chad Anderson, and we're going to pick up where we left off. And actually, I'm going to switch gears a little bit. I'd like to talk about this new administration, Elon Musk and Donald Trump, or Donald Trump and Elon Musk, however which way you look at it. And I'm wondering what you make of this romance, oh, I should just say partnership. And how do you see that impacting our industry?
Yeah, we've in our Space IQ report and kind of also more publicly, we've talked about, puts forward predictions for 2025. And obviously, the new administration coming in, they're taking a different approach. I mean, I think there's a lot of consensus. And even in the first few weeks, we've already seen this start to play out. There's a real focus on the space economy. There is a focus on leveraging commercial capabilities, pro-growth, focusing on streamlining regulations. I think we're starting to see all that play out, already start to play out, and there's going to be more of that. I think that SpaceX is likely to be the biggest beneficiary of this.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think most people will point to the fact that, because of its first buddy status, that and I think that that's certainly true. I think that he does have significant influence in this administration. He was one of the largest donors. He was the largest donor to the campaign, right? So so all of that is going to impact things. But at the same time, SpaceX has the best solution on the market, and in some cases, the only solution. So if the government is looking to get something done, SpaceX is usually the best choice. Regardless of their relationship. So I think in the last administration, we saw some hesitation to want to work with Musk and several of his companies, despite the fact that SpaceX was doing so much for the country and the importance of what they're building. There was hesitation to work with him personally. That is no longer the case. So, how does that play out? I don't know. I think there's going to be a lot. There is a lot of more government dollars, defense related dollars that are going to commercial space capabilities. I think the US government, like many governments, is awakened to the fact that space technologies are essential for our economic growth and national security and are investing heavily. I think that SpaceX is going to play a key role there, as they already are. They'll play an increasingly large role there. Thinking about the Artemis program and going to the moon through this complex architecture using, various international partners and, large incumbent sort of older technologies. I think that some of that goes away and there's more sort of an interest in leveraging a more streamlined Starship infrastructure, even though it's still a test program and they still have to work some kinks out. I think there's already more of an emphasis on leveraging that architecture, and the idea of going more direct to Mars rather than going to the moon first. I think we, again, in the first few weeks of this administration, we've already seen that start to play out with both Trump and Elon saying that that the moon isn't necessarily where they want to be focused, and they're more focused on going straight to Mars. So we'll see. We'll see exactly how that plays out, but those are kind of the broad brush strokes.
Well, you sort of have to hope that all boats rise in the tide. And I think when you're talking about SpaceX, to be gracious to Elon Musk, he has opened things up a great deal. He has lowered the cost of entry. He certainly has. He's gotten an awful lot of other people's satellites into orbit. So fingers crossed there. I don't know about this. Planting the flag on Mars, we can't even get our little samples back from Mars at the moment. So that just seems to be that's a nod to Musk's dreams. But We shall see. But that.
Still a lot to figure out between now and there, but SpaceX has a what do they say? That they specialize in making the impossible late. So they've got a pretty good track record of delivering.
Well, and all the things that you really need to figure out and do between now and when you can get it. I mean, robots to Mars, that might not be so hard, but it's very difficult to get an astronaut to Mars, I should think. And that said, imagine all of the brain power it's going to take to noodle that and figure all of that out. And that, I think, is going to be extremely beneficial for the industry. Just all of that concentrated effort trying to figure out how to. Grow food on Mars or, protect people from radiation, keep astronauts' bones healthy during a 2-year travel period. It's going to be a lot of technology and a lot of biology that needs to be figured out. What do you think? I guess Isaacman has not yet, I don't know whether he's been confirmed yet for
They
NASA.
haven't had the hearings yet, yeah.
But him, I have a lot of admiration for him. That could be a very interesting piece of the puzzle.
I agree.
Anyway, yeah.
He's
So.
got he look, he's got a really interesting background, and he's got a lot of vested interest in this. He's incredibly knowledgeable. I think that we've got there's probably a handful of really great folks that would make great NASA administrators. I mean, having him in the running, I think, is a net positive. We'll see how the hearings and
I agree
confirmation go.
there. He is a man of passion and compassion as well. All he did for St. Jude's with the Inspiration 4 mission, that was really impressive. Another thing that Donald Trump has recently announced is this Iron Dome initiative, which makes me think about the Department of Defense and the changes that we've are slowly seeing unfolding with them. And I'm wondering what your take is on commercial companies interacting with the Department of Defense. Do you think this kind of concept of buy before you build is finally taking hold, or is this still rhetoric?
Yeah, so the Iron Dome is an old idea in new packaging. It's been talked about for a long time in a lot of different ways. I think that space can offer a lot in terms of defensive rapid response, defensive capabilities. So interesting to see this coming back up again and being a topic of conversation. I do think that there is a sort of seismic shift that is underway, has been underway for the last 10 years or so, of the US government moving away from the old way of doing business with incumbents, pre-SpaceX, when there was a very limited market, there was a handful of defense contractors on the supply side, and the government really is the sole customer on the other. We've come a long way from that. To where we are today. And that is due to SpaceX, and that is due to some folks in government that had the insight and the courage to go against the grain. I write about this in my book, but Mike Griffin, that was a NASA administrator in 2005, was instrumental in SpaceX's emergence. He gave the initial contracts to SpaceX for the Commercial Orbital Transportation Services program, which was a fixed price contract to deliver cargo to the International Space Station for NASA. And they obviously delivered on that contract, and Elon, got up on stage afterwards and gave a lot of thanks to NASA for what they'd done. And I think that was a really important turning point, going from this sort of world of cost plus contracts, where, hey, I need you to build this thing. Okay, well, it's going to cost, X dollars to build it, and we're going to, build in Y percent margin, and you just pay us what it costs us to build it plus that margin, right? Which is actually very perverse incentives that caused the incumbents to realize that if they never deliver their contract or they go over time and over budget, they actually make more money. So fixed price contracts were a key turning point in this story, because you need to deliver on time and on the budget that you set. Otherwise, you take the hit. And we've seen that play out most clearly in the commercial crew program, which, SpaceX was the underdog. They delivered years ahead of Boeing. Boeing Starliner finally got to the space station with two astronauts last year, and they were deemed unsafe to bring it back. So then SpaceX had to go up, and is the pro in the process of rescuing them and bringing those astronauts home. So for me, this was a really sort of monumental symbolic turning point in where the incumbents were unable to deliver, and where SpaceX has very now clearly overtaken them. So all of that to say that there is that has kickstarted a lot of other the success of SpaceX on these and these fixed price contracts has kicked off a very large wave across government, which is going counter to the culture, and it's a very big ship that we're turning here. But it is slowly happening. Across agencies, there is an interest in leveraging more commercial capabilities so that you can get better capability, more cutting-edge technology, with less dollars. And so we're seeing those initiatives now permeate and start to play out and to deliver results. And I think we're only going to see more of that.
So we have a lot of missions that are coming up, coming out of commercial vendors. We've got lunar landers, commercial space station, Rocket Lab's got another rocket coming online, the Neutron. We've got Sierra Space's Dream Chaser. All of these are, aimed at government missions. Get us to the moon.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of government dollars. There is a large and growing enterprise customer base. But the US government, the governments around the world are a big buyer of satellite capability, space technologies and their applications. So, and will continue to be, I'm sure.
Of course, there's a lot of starts and stops. We just saw two high visibility launches. Starship, of course, going up for I think it was the eighth time, and New Glenn with its, maiden voyage. And I know both of these last launches succeeded in some ways and disappointed in others, as is often the case. But I'm wondering what do you think? Do you think either of these vehicles are going to be truly operational anytime this year or anytime soon? Where in their trajectory are they really?
Yeah, I mean, it's great to see Blue Origin actually reach orbit. I mean, they were founded at the same time as SpaceX. Both companies were founded in 2002. Both of them, through 2022, I think, had invested about the same amount of money. SpaceX had raised capital. Jeff Bezos was investing his own dollars, but they roughly had invested the same amount of money over the first 20 years of their company's lives. And if you look, just look at what SpaceX has accomplished versus what Blue Origin has accomplished. It's apples and oranges, right? So their launch has really been a one company show. Rocket Lab has been the only other operational, privately funded operational rocket, smaller vehicle. Not really competing with the Falcon 9, serving a sort of a different subset of the market. So having Blue Origin launch their New Glenn vehicle on and get to orbit on their first try is really exceptional. Now getting from first flight to operations is easier said than done. It's actually incredibly difficult. To do. And so we'll see how effective they are. I think that the new CEO has brought some urgency to the equation. He's got the team He's effectively moved the team out of R&D mode into manufacturing and operations mode that allowed them to reach orbit for the first time. We'll see how effective they are in actually, getting up to a launch cadence this year. But it's pretty exciting to see more vehicles coming online. Rocket Lab continues to execute, so it'll be great to see them with their larger vehicle come on and eat into a larger part of the market. SpaceX's Starship, that it is incredible to see how fast that test program has advanced. I think a lot of that has to do with, you'll hear them on their webcast talk about how the data is the payload. They have Starlink connectivity, high speed Starlink connectivity almost through every stage, every second of the flight. They're getting incredible amounts of data back that's allowing them to progress this test program faster than anyone has ever seen. With something like this. And so it's great to see how far they've come in such a little in such a short period. They still have more things to figure out. I think, in this latest flight, they had dummy payloads mimicking their new Starlink satellites, their new larger satellites. I think, once they prove to themselves that this vehicle is capable of launching and getting these dummy payloads to orbit, then they can quickly move to putting their own Starlink satellites on the vehicle, which then accelerates their market adoption because then they can prove to customers, look, we're launching our own satellites and it's working just fine. Look, this vehicle is still in its test program phase. They still have quite a few things to do and check off the list, but it's really fantastic to see how fast it's been advancing. And I do think that we're going to see the vehicle become operational. I mean, launching actual satellites in the first half of this year.
So I'm sort of kind of going to go back to something. I'm going to go back to the space economy. Now, of course, I've read from various financial firms that the space economy is expected to be worth $1 trillion in less than 10 years. But when I think about SpaceX, I'm thinking they're going to be worth $1 trillion in probably less than 5 years. So I'm wondering, are we underestimating or overestimating the space economy? Where do you see it going?
Well, if you go back to what we were talking about in the beginning, which is that this is a massive of opportunity. It's kind of a func it's a function of how you view the opportunity set, right? Most people have a hesitation to think about applications in terms of, are location-based services actually do those count as space companies, right? A lot of people don't believe that that's the case. Going back to GPS, the Commerce Department a couple of years ago came out with a report that tried to size up the economic benefits of GPS. And they were saying that it's generated trillions of dollars in economic value globally. Since it came online, it has certainly given rise to some of the largest venture companies and the largest investor returns that we've ever seen on the application side. So, if you just look at GPS alone, this is already, I mean, the Commerce Department report said in the US alone, it's generated $1.5 trillion of economic value. So, you look at that from a global perspective, like, yes, GPS alone is already trillions of dollars in value. So that's not accounting for any of the other pieces of the space economy, the satellite communications, the Earth observation, geospatial intelligence piece, which are large and growing very rapidly, right? So, look, when we came out with these frameworks initially, several years ago, they were considered contrarian. I think more and more people are starting to adopt them. The World Economic Forum wrote a report with McKinsey talking about the one point, it's going to be $1.8 trillion. The space economy is going to be valued at $1.8 trillion in the next few years. Again, I think that they've leveraged our frameworks to help understand the breadth of the opportunity. I still think that they are underestimating. I think we're already the space economy is already generating trillions of dollars. It is. The modern global economy runs on GPS, and things are about to accelerate with Starship coming online. And I think, yeah, I mean, I think if you talk to the folks, the executives at the company, that they would tell you that there's a handful of trillion-dollar companies on the traded on the public markets, and that SpaceX could be one of those. What they're doing is just too important, again, for economic growth, national security, and it's hard to see them slowing down anytime soon.
There are some other industry growth factors too that seem to be coming into focus. For example, I mean, of course, we've got climate change, but climate change in the bigger picture is also all of these things that are going to impact insurance companies or build or what, forest fires that are devastating Los Angeles and floods that are devastating parts of the United States and parts of the world. And then we have space sustainability, something where we see the need and the problem, the problems of space debris, the need for collision avoidance, all of those things. And we're just at the beginning, at the very beginning of getting any real solutions out there. We've got AI, which of course we've touched on previously, but that's going to grow exponentially. And the huge data sets that we just create out of our space economy lend themselves to AI. And then also there's going to be some shifting industry consolidation. What do you make of all of that? Do you think those are really going to push the economy even further?
Yeah, I mean, look, extreme weather events like heat waves, floods, wildfires are becoming more frequent, impacting more people, further straining insurance markets, like you mentioned. I mean, LA is an example of this. You've got a fire, which is bad enough in the first place, and then you got hurricane winds, that are accelerating the spread and causing devastation, a lot of devastation. We don't have any good solutions for that, but we're working on it. So we've got a company in our portfolio called Muon Space. The CEO, founder of the company, was the chief engineer at Skybox Imaging, has a lot of experience building fantastic, sophisticated satellites that work. There is an Earth Fire Alliance, Google.org, the Moore Foundation, the Environmental Defense Fund have put money and capability together in this initiative, and they've are working with Muon to build a constellation of satellites to detect wildfires the size of a small classroom anywhere on the planet within 15 minutes of them starting, which will actually enable us to take action to get that data into the hands of first responders to go out and do something and put those fires out before they become a problem. The first satellite, the prototype satellite for that, is launching next month. So this is real and happening soon. A lot of the team at Muon actually worked on MethaneSat, a satellite that was funded by the Environmental Defense Fund. That launched last year is going to be the first satellite. It is the first satellite to be detecting methane emissions at a global scale, which, before this, it was basically just self-reported. So this is the first verifiable independent data source on methane emissions globally. So, half of essential climate variables can only be measured from space, and 99% of weather forecasts come from space, right? These are technologies, to understand and address global challenges. We need global solutions, and that's what satellites provide. So, despite the fact that this administration has sort of made a sharp turn on climate policy, I think there's a lot of private initiatives underway that should give us a lot of hope.
Oh, I love this point of view. It makes me feel very proud of the industry. It really does. Chad, I would like to speak with you forever, but I know I can't. We're running out of time. And I'm wondering if you've got any, before we say goodbye, any parting words that you'd like to leave our audience with?
Just that the growth here is pretty hard to get your head around. So if you look at the number of satellites launched to orbit over time, it's currently like a straight line up. The number of satellites on orbit is growing faster than the rate of Moore's law. It's doubling. The number of satellites in orbit's doubling every 18 months and accelerating. There is a ton of growth here. Trying to get your arms around everything that's happening. It's getting increasingly difficult to do and to keep up with. I'd say another thing to keep an eye on for the coming year is space traffic coordination, making sure that we keep our orbits safe, clear, and safe to, so that we can continue operating and providing these essential services. And this is an area that we've been investing in, for quite a few years and are continuing to invest in. So definitely an area of opportunity for your listeners to watch.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I just want our listeners to know if you want to learn more about how space enables the global economy and to access Space Capital's quarterly reports and live stream discussions, go to spacecapital, all one word, .com. So again, Chad, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate your taking the time to be with us today. And this was a very informative and, as always, so insightful conversation. So have a wonderful rest of your day, Chad, and we'll see
Thank
you
you.
next
Thanks for
time.
having me. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
That is all for this episode. Until next time, stay connected.